Hey, this is Christian Horn from Part-Time Fanboy. So coming up, we have the second part of my interview with comic book creator Evan Dorkin. In this section, Mr. Dorkin sort of goes into his early career, how he got started in comics, and the creation of Milk and Cheese. Honestly, we probably could have had like 2, 3, 4 hours with Mr. Dorkin. He was very generous with his time. So I just want to take this moment to thank Evan Dorkin for coming on the podcast. He's honestly been one of my favorite comic book creators for a long time, and I was very honored to have him on the podcast. So without further ado, here is part two of my interview with Evan Dorkin.
Part-time fanboy. Fanboy.com.
But at what point, so you're drawing your own stuff, and it seems like what, or at least like your early stuff seems like it seems, at least according to your Wikipedia page,
Don't look at me. I had nothing to do with it.
No, I'm just saying, like, this may not be accurate, but did you start off in fanzines? And then, because they have, like, it seems like your very first thing, or at least the very first thing that I recognize is Pirate Corps. And
Paracore, No, I
was
got rid of it because people called it corpse, but got rid of the title. I mean,
yeah, and so
that's my second book.
that's your, Figments. It looks, is Figments your first book?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I've never seen that, so I don't know anything about
If
it.
you've got 50 cents in a dream, you can get it on eBay.
I'll look it up.
It's not really a dream.
Well, I'm just saying, like, you were you going to conventions? Were you like
I
doing
was going to
pages?
convention. I was going to conventions because, like I said, I've been going to conventions since I was like 12, 13, because
Oh,
back
okay.
then we weren't all afraid of getting snatched off the street by phantom molesters. I mean, it happens, but you know what I'm saying? Now
Yeah.
you'll get arrested if your kid did the things that we all did normally, and I'm only 50.
Yeah.
This 37 years ago, I have a 10-year-old daughter, and there's no way in 2, 2.5 years I'm going to let her get on a bus to go take a train to go to a convention and walk around with
Yeah.
strange, a couple of thousand strangers, then get back on the train at night and come back to Staten Island. But that's what I did. I was living in Brooklyn. I was 13. You take a bus and your mom says, "What you coming back?" Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
City to see William Shatner talk and to see John Buscema give an interview and buy comics and look at homemade props that people made from Logan's Run and Star Trek. It was great, but
But you had your art and you were shopping it around at that age?
no,
No.
I guess when I was working at the comic shop or a little before that, I started. I knew that they had fan artists at the table. Back then, they had enough space and there were fewer people in the industry, and it wasn't such a big professional mercenary thing like it is now, where people put up a wall of Adventure Time and Doctor Who drawings,
Yeah.
and sell prints of things that they don't own. And you could just I just you could get a fan artist table.
Oh.
Just talk to somebody at the convention. You know what I mean? You just go and I'd like, you register for a table. They were free. But I was two th three things I did not do back th four things I did not do back then. I did not go on job interviews that my mother sent me to go on because I was afraid. So I would just tell her I went in and they didn't hire me. I'd stand outside the A&W and then go back a half hour later. I would not talk. I would not ask girls out in high school. Not show. I did not have a portfolio to show to anybody, and I would not talk to anybody in any kind of official capacity to go, "Hey, I'd like a table. Where can I fill out a form?" I was terrified of that kind of stuff. The only reason I got a job at McDonald's is because I ran into three friends who were walking there, and they told me, "Why don't you come along? We're gonna fill out." So that was safe. I felt safe.
But then how did you make that jump? Because it takes a big leap of faith to, even at our age, to be like, hey, look at this. Does this suck or what?
same way that I ran into those three friends, I never thought about it like this, but in the same way that I ran into those three friends in my neighborhood who were all going to McDonald's to fill out the forms, and I felt safe in a group of people who were more confident than me. I was working at the comic store. The reason I got the job at the Fantastic Store was because I was a customer and I was always there. And, you know, stores hire from their customers.
Gotcha.
So I ended up working there. Jim Hanley and his partner.
And that's the shop that's still in Manhattan, right?
He left that shop.
Oh, really?
He left that shop and opened Jim Hanley's Universe in Eltingville. That's where I got that name from.
Ah.
And I was fired from the Fantastic Store because whatever. And I was pretty much dating my first girlfriend, so it was like I was a little too not paying attention to my job. Let's put that way.
Okay.
And plus, I was a super obnoxious person to be around. I could sell comics and I was good at the register and I was honest, but I was a real jerk.
Okay.
High Fidelity, apparently, the movie is in the book, I guess.
Yeah.
If you take that and make it comics, I guess, supposedly, that was me.
That was you. So,
yeah, I'm always apologizing to people who I used to sell comics to back in the day. I felt comfortable enough because I was asked to work there. And then I was rehired at Jim Hanley's Universe. And the people who were there, some of them were interested in making comics. One of the customers was a guy named Alan Rollins. He was getting work writing fill-ins for Marvel and DC at the time. So he was getting his foot in there. And then he asked me to design the characters for his creator-owned book.
Oh, okay.
So he asked me. That's how I ended up doing Figments. Doing Figments, some people who had seen my work when we had pitched it to them and they didn't take it, were working at Deluxe Lodestone. They formed Eternity Comics. Uh-huh. They remembered some of the stuff that I had seen. They called me up and said, do you want to do a book based on that stuff? That was Pirate Corps. I did not know how to go into any place on my own. We had interviews at Marvel to get fill-in work and to try to get freelancing work. Alan set those up. That's how I met Gene, and he gave the best crit. He was totally friendly, honest, and real.
And who was that?
The great Archie Goodwin.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, that was fantastic. Because we met another editor who was an absolute prick. He lorded over us. He made fun of us. He was just, you know, I've got the desk. You want in? I'm going to.
Yeah.
Take out all my childhood trauma on you guys, everyone else walks in. He had two Magnum 44s handcuffed to his desk like he was a big shot.
What?
Yeah.
That's insane. Yeah.
Isn't it, though? but in the same way, the way that I got my table at... I never had a portfolio that I bring to companies. I was too afraid. Pirate Corps was a failed attempt to work up a pitch for Marvel.
Oh, okay.
Original Pirate Corps comics that my friend Brian Marshall and Tony Eng, who started Eternity, they had seen these sketches. It was the Pirate Corps was a group of characters set in the Marvel Universe. I had done like 10 pages of a Fantastic Four Avengers crossover that these characters were the villains in, even though they were comedic villains.
Yeah.
And it was all built in. One of the members of the team was a Skrull, who I obviously had to take out. But I was too afraid to show them. I sold the pitch pages that I did for DC back in the day. I wanted to do a Who's Who page really badly.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get work, and I did a bunch of pages, and I never showed them. I just could not do that. The way I got the table, I'm trying to do interviews better, but
this is a podcast.
I'm sticking to it pretty good, and I'm not doing shtick. The way I got the table at the creation conventions was I snuck into the convention because I didn't have money, so I snuck in through the kitchen with a coworker from Jim Hanley's. He figured out a way to sneak up to the convention floor. It was like on the 8th floor or 17th, you know, it wasn't on the front. And it was at the Statler Hilton, which is the Penn Pavilion, Pennsylvania. What the hell's the name of that place? The Penn... Anyway, I think it just finally closed down. But it's the famous one. The Mike Carbonaro shows were still being held there, the terrible Mike Carbonaro shows. But we'd go up through the kitchen, and I would literally just sit down at someone's table and put my stuff out.
Really?
This was terrifying to me. the reason I started, I've mentioned this before. The reason that I first did this was because of desperate need.
Okay.
I was 19 and I needed to pay for my girlfriend's abortion.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It happens.
Wow. No, I'm...
What do you mean? Wait. It was a very, very terrible thing.
I'm not making fun of it. I'm just like.
I mentioned this once back in the day in a journal interview, but yeah, it's, you know, not something I'm, that I'm excited about, but I needed, $200. And I wasn't going to ask my parents for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a tough time, obviously.
Yeah.
Both of us, and I told her I would make the money, and I did not have any meat, so there was a convention scheduled, and I thought, well, I'll sit down and I'll do sketches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I made, I think, and I sat down at, oh God, he, the guy who did The Punisher, Mike Zeck. He had his name on a sticker on a table, and it was weird because it was a round hotel, you know, dinner tables. Which was really awkward to set up on. And I just took his sticker off and I sat down, and I was terrified he would show up.
Yeah.
I was terrified I'd get caught, but nobody ever cared because the amateur artists, nobody knew who any of the amateur artists were who were just doing sketches. We were in the section of the convention where it was just like, you know, none of the well-known people were coming over there, and none of the dealers were there, and none of the none of the big-time artists were over there. So the guys who ran the convention, they never came over because they're going to hang out with Scotty, or they're going to go look at the Filk Singer and the Evan Dorkin. So nobody cared. And Mike Zeck never even showed up, because a lot of the times conventions will put people's names on stuff hoping they'll show up. Or being, you know what I mean? They don't show up. The Greenberg shows were great for that. You know, every year Howard Chaykin was a guest, and every year he never showed up. And he wasn't going to show up, but you put somebody's name on there, you might sell some tickets, so you get their name.
So was that where you sort of kind of got discovered a little bit, or?
No. But what it did was it got me. I started doing that regularly, twice a year at that show, and then. Once I started getting work, you could then go, you feel a little bit more comfortable, or eventually you meet enough people where you just go, you know, I'm doing this for, you know, why don't I just get a table like a real person?
Yeah.
But yeah, I was doing $10 superhero sketches. And I did it for a couple of years from like before I was full time doing comics, for like 2 years, 3 years, I did $10 superhero sketches at any convention that I could get myself to, or store signing. And they, you know, most of it was miserable. I did a convention that nobody came to my table. I was the only artist in this gym, and I fell asleep on my table.
Really?
Yeah, I was exhausted. And after about an hour or two of just sitting there and feeling miserable, I was in between like 30 comics dealers, you know, and I was just this one table with artwork on it, and nobody talked to me. And I don't blame them, you know. There was no, I had no characters I could show them. I had no Marvel or DC work. They didn't care about what I was doing.
Yeah.
I think I just had my first book out, maybe. I don't even know. Wow. But yeah, it was weird. It was kind of like, you know, playing musical gigs at CB's for three people.
Yeah.
But I'd do the conventions, and I got to know. There were people like Jamal Eagle and stuff like that I remember from back in the day. And, you know, all of us kind of, you know, people trying to break in would hang out and talk at the conventions. I met my friend Robbie Bush there, who ended up becoming, you know, coloring and writing for DC and Marvel. And through him, I met the guys from Instant Piano, like Kyle Baker.
Yeah.
I met Mazzucchelli I adopted his cat, and then we became friends. And it was just, you know, the New York area was still the place to live.
Sure.
For comic. It was before the internet. It was before FedEx, pretty much, or you could, you know, it was before faxing even. So you brought your work in, and
it was networking, right? Pretty much.
Yeah. Well, it was networking, but you know, I didn't really meet anybody through that. I met people through, because I worked at the comic store, oddly enough. The first time I did San Diego, again, the guys from Eternity asked if I'd go to San Diego. I said, I can't go to San Diego. How do I do that?
Uh-huh.
You know, it was 1987. My mother put up the money for the flight because they had a hotel room. So she said, you should go. My mother was, you know, in a good mood that week or whatever the hell, but she was right.
Yeah.
You should go. You should promote yourself. So I went there. PyroCorp was going to be – Figments had already come out, and I'd already learned a couple of life lessons by then. Alan had got me a job at DC on No Talent Showcase, New Talent Showcase. You know, I used to say No Talent Showcase as a joke, and now I say it without even thinking about it. But my check fell behind the door, and I didn't get paid for a while. And my story never saw print, thankfully. So that was an interesting eye-opening experience. Your check could disappear, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And your work might not get printed.
Yeah.
And it also, it's not a big deal when you get work. Nobody cares. You care. But it's business as usual for everyone else, you know? I got a Marvel job because a person I knew from college was working there.
Yeah.
Again, I needed to have somebody hold my hand in a lot of ways because I was just too afraid of presenting myself. So that's why I never really had a presentation portfolio. I didn't even have a portfolio. I don't know what the hell I had my artwork in back in the day. But I did this Marvel job, and I spent like a week to just drawing these two pages that were mostly it was for a Marvel Universe, and it was not a lot of art, and I kept erasing it, redoing it, and it was terrible, but I really tried, and so I was really excited to bring it in and show it to them, you know?
Yeah.
And this guy Greg, he looks at it, he goes, okay, good. He goes, here's an invoice. He didn't even, you know, I'm wow. I was like, is that all there is? Like, you know, and then when I did
you wanted fanfare.
I wanted
acknowledgement.
No, I wanted something. But not necessarily from him. I wanted it to be a moment. I thought it was an important thing, and I worked very hard. And I didn't realize it. I was like probably 19. They have guys come in who are very talented, bringing their artwork in, who they care about seeing. They're not, you know, this was a charity job from this guy. So it was like it's not that. It's like a guy bringing in, you know, a car at the lube shop. It's work.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. And then when we did Figments, it sold something like 24,000 copies.
Oh.
And the money that we made on it did not reflect that. Let's put it that way.
Oh, really?
That was my one time of getting taken.
Oh.
Comics. But it was good that it happened early and that it happened on something like that where it wasn't my creations.
Yeah.
But that was and my artwork was returned to me with blue pencil jokes written on it.
Yeah.
And somebody in the art department, if they had an art department and it wasn't just two guys, you know, with desks, played tic-tac-toe on my pages, some of my pages in blue pencil.
Are you serious?
Very serious. They.
That's fucked up.
Yeah, and that also one of the people who worked on that book went around a convention telling people I would never have a job in comics.
What?
I would never have a future in comics.
That's horrible.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it was a smaller industry, so this shit got back to me because it was a New York convention.
Yeah.
But, you know, I sometimes I wish he was right.
Okay. No.
I stuck around, you know.
Well, so
PyroCorp did PyroCorp helped me get some work from people at the San Diego convention. Byron Price was there, and I didn't know it at the time, but he was basically looking for new people who didn't cost much.
Uh-huh.
To do this series of Bank Street books of science fiction comic adaptations of science fiction books for young readers. And it was terrible pay, but I didn't know that at the time. But it was fun work, and it was the first time I tried inking myself, which was a disaster. They should have called FEMA in after I did that.
Oh, come on.
But the thing is, everything was a building, was a step.
Sure.
And, I got the PyroCorp book was terrible. It just wasn't what I wanted it to be because I knew what good comics were and I knew that this wasn't it. But I couldn't show my work to people and I still have problems with that sort of thing, I still wanted to do this. Do you know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
Even though I'd see the results of my work and go, Jesus, this is not great, but I knew I was getting better.
Yeah.
I was a latecomer. I was self-taught. I didn't think my artwork got really decent until I was about 30, 35,
huh.
Told, but I knew that I could get better. I mean, I did know that if I kept working, I would get better, especially if I wanted to get better.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's growing pains. You have to do a lot of, only a few people are amazing at an early age.
Yeah.
And those people get better. Yeah. You know, you Stephen DeStefano or Kyle Baker or people like that, they had a real flair. They knew what they were doing, and they got even better.
Yeah.
And they chose to be better. I mean, Steven has gotten better and better. Kyle can be better when he wants to be, in my opinion.
Well, wait, I
don't want to be a dick, but I mean, the computer, I think, impacted on his work in a way that I don't find attractive.
Okay. But let me ask you this. So when does Milk and Cheese, like, get into your head? Because that seems like it might have been the thing that broke you through, right?
Yeah. Well, the thing that broke me through, yeah. The first convention, I was drawing them on envelopes and packages to people that I was, you know, I'd send stuff to Amazing Heroes or the Buyer's Guide to try to get some artwork printed in the fan pages. And I had the Buyer's Guide always turned me down. And Amazing Heroes ran, I think, a couple of things. Mm-hmm. I would just draw him on the envelopes. I mean, you know, it's a shame that we don't have as much envelope. You know, envelope art would have made a nice book in about 1990.
Yeah.
Before everybody started, you know, FedExing or scanning or whatever the hell. But yeah, I sent a lot of mail out.
Yeah.
To readers and to fanzines and things. Not necessarily looking for work. I wasn't I guess I kind of did that later on, but in the late 80s, after I met a few people at conventions, I stayed in touch with Bob Schreck and Diana Schatz. They were really kind to me. I met them at the first convention. They invited me to a party at the Kimiko party, where the conventions were small enough that you would have Marvel people, DC people, Fantagraphics, Kimiko, you know, Bob Burden would be doing Bob Burden stuff, but it'd be a smaller group of people. So you could meet a lot of the people at the convention right then and there.
Yeah.
You can't do that at conventions anymore. There's more parties than there are people in that room now.
Yeah.
But that was really, really good. I ended up 2 years later working for Bob Burden for 2 weeks as a paid assistant on an issue of Flaming Carrot. Bob and Diana got me a job filling in for an artist that fell out of a Predator project. And I got Bill and Ted around the same time as the Predator book, because I had met Fabian Nicieza at a marketing meeting in San Diego when I was with the store. In 1988, I went back to San Diego and I had no work. PirateCorps had been canceled by Eternity. I think I was writing something called Wild Nights still for them, but I was working in a comic shop trying to get comics work and working in a punk club on Staten Island as a bar back cleaning up the joint. And I didn't know how to get work, but at this party, I got pretty drunk and I acted up, and Fabian remembered me. And when he left marketing to go into editing, he needed somebody to do the Bill and Ted book, and he knew that PirateCorps had bands in it that nobody had heard of. That's what he said. And he knew that I did humor stuff, because at the time, PirateCorps had come out and some Milk and Cheese strips had come out. And I think around that same time, I was getting Milk and Cheese number one together, because I had had so many strips sitting around. When I started doing strips, because I know everything's a story, Jesus. Like I said, in 87, I was doing these little funny drawings of Milk and Cheese. I'd come up with them drunk in a restaurant at about like 3 in the morning with friends of mine from Eternity. We had gone to see a ska show at CBGB's. And I was just waiting for food and drawing crap, and Milk and Cheese is one of the things I drew.
Wow.
My friend liked it, and he kept it, and I just kept drawing them because they were easy to draw. And in fact, at one point, Burden, while I was working with him, he said, you should stop doing that PirateCorps stuff and do Milk and Cheese. They're easier to draw. You'll get more done.
Yeah.
It was true for a few years, and then I started putting more detail into them. But I was at the convention doing fans. Again, I had a free fan table at San Diego in 87, and I drew Milk and Cheese for people because I had no characters to draw.
Yeah.
And back then you drew a lot more sketches because there was a lot less people drawing.
Yeah.
So every kids would just come up to me and go, can you draw me something? And they'd give you a backing board. They didn't know who you were. They didn't care. Yeah. So I would draw Milk and Cheese flipping people the bird, and not kids. And I would say, burn your comics and obnoxious things like that.
Yeah.
I ended up making the acquaintance of Steve Niles and Kurt Sayenga. And Steve might have still been in Gray Matter, the band he was in. Mm-hmm. Kurt Sayenga was doing a comics music zine called Greed, and we ended up all talking. I guess anybody who had a funny band t-shirt on ran into, you know, saw a kindred spirit to talk to. And he said, if you do a strip with those guys, I'll run it in Greed. And I'm like, oh, a strip? I didn't even think of that. So I did 2 pages and sent them to him, and he ran them in the last issue of Greed. Greed went under. But people had seen Greed and asked me to do more Milk and Cheese strips for their zines or comics anthologies, and I ended up doing like 6 pages that all, none of them saw print because the company, by the time I got everything done, the companies would go out of business because it was literally, companies wouldn't last 6 months.
Yeah.
So something called Asylum from one company I did pages for, and then I ended up doing one page for Dave Sim for the backup of Serapis Bi-Weekly. Uh-huh. Because he did a cattle call, you know, he said, send me a strip, and if I like it, I'll run it. And that made more sense to me than trying to, you know, just send a blank thing. So that ended up, I got $200 for that, which was really exciting at the time. I think it was 200. And so I ended up with like 12 pages of Milk and Cheese. And I at that point, I was running Pirate Corps was being published by SLG, by Slave Labor.
Yeah.
Because I had met Dan in 87 and I was at the table next to him and he couldn't stand me because I had a bell that I would ring when I finished an art
piece. Oh my God.
And I had a clapping monkey that I would wind up to get people to look at the table. It was easier than talking to people.
Yeah.
I could talk, but I couldn't say, come on over here.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So we got to talking, and he thought I was obnoxious, but then he ended up reading some of my comics over the year, and then the next year when I had no work, so this was, 88 was an amazing year for me. I met Fabian, and like 2 years later, that became work. I was still hanging out with people from Dark Horse, and that ended up becoming work, and I've been working for them since 91. Yeah. Almost nonstop. I've almost always, every year, done something for Dark Horse.
Yeah.
And I met Dan, and we got to talking, and I kind of had asked him if he would be interested in taking Pirate Corps on, but then I didn't really talk to him about it, but then at a party, he was really drunk, I was really drunk, and Scott Saavedra, the cartoonist, was really drunk, and Scott made us shake hands on it.
Oh.
So like, I was like, thanks, Scott, but the next day I was afraid that Dan was drunk, and he just said it to be nice,
yeah.
So I avoided him the whole next day, and then finally ran into him, and he said, don't you want to do the comic with a, you know, what's up? And I said, yeah, I just figured you were being nice. So yeah, I had a real bad way of getting work.
it sounds like it.
It seemed what happened was I was mildly talented, but I was fun to hang around with, maybe.
Oh no.
And no, I'm serious. And you know, and the thing is, I think that the fun to hang around with quality was in my comics.
Yeah.
So even though my comics really look bad from around then, I mean, they're just bad. My inking was terrible and my lettering was atrocious. But they were like punk 45s that worked okay, you know? They were badly produced, but they were fun, I guess.
Well, I mean, I
but
was one
refined,
of the...
You know, it gets refined when you work on it. You just don't want to take off all the rough edges.
Yeah.
But that's, in a nut, I think you just got the history of my first... 4 or 5 years of in the industry.
Well, and that's what I was asking about. So, you know, I just feel bad. At this point, I've had you on for almost like an hour and a half. Are you okay? Or
I'm dying here. I talked to Tom Spurgeon for 13 hours once.
Holy shit, really?
Yeah, see, this is why. At some point, you're going to have to leave.
Well,
yeah. I don't do that many interviews, and my family doesn't want to hear about my comics. So.
And
I like talking about comics, believe it or not.
Well, you can come on my show anytime and talk about comics for as long as you want.
I'll see you tomorrow. I'll do like walk-ins like Bob Hope. So what questions did you have?
No, I mean, well...
I'll talk for an hour if you ask me anything open-ended about my career, about getting in and all that, because I haven't thought about that stuff in a while, and
no, but Milk and Cheese, I mean,
that was a fluke, yeah.
Yeah, but it's something that took off because you made like several books, right? I mean, you made a decent chunk of like issues.
Basically, I feel like I was at San Diego. San Diego was a great show for me, you know what I'm saying? It was the one time a year everybody got together and you got to see a lot of people, and it was the only real big, huge show.
Yeah.
There was Chicago was big, from what I understand, and Dallas Fantasy Fair, but... San Diego really was it.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you have a major convention. I think there's one in my garage right now.
I would be surprised.
Right. There's more conventions than there are readers, it feels like sometimes. Paying readers. But I said to Dan at some point, I've got all these pages of Milk and Cheese. Would you want to do a book with them? And he just said, sure, what the hell? We had no idea. I mean, but it was pretty cheap to just toss a book out there.
Yeah.
And you did a cover and a solicitation paragraph. You sent it out to the distributors back when you could put an S on distributor, because we had like five of them, and they ran it. And if you got enough copies ordered, you made the book.
Yeah.
And it was out within months. Nowadays, you know, you have to wait a year for your collection. You know, if your book distributor is mass market, mainstream, you have to wait a year to get a Dark Horse book out.
Yeah.
You start putting it together. It's bizarre because it felt like you could get a comic out in 3 months.
Yeah.
From like saying, I have an idea for a comic, go do it, here it is.
Wow.
It was pretty amazing. It was great. You would just keep having comics coming out. But Milk and Cheese 1 sold like 3,000 copies, which was sadly, nowadays that would, you know, a lot of people would be happy with 3,000, but back then it was like, you know, not so great, but it sold out pretty quickly. And it ended up, I think we did 9 printings of the first one over time.
Oh, wow.
And kept everything in print. But we ended up doing 7 issues of Milk and Cheese. And then the same thing happened with Dork. I was supposed to be doing this 10 pages for this book called Instant Piano. And a lawyer got involved on behalf of one of the artists.
Oh.
And kind of treated the project as if there was money in it when it was just a 40. It was a 50, 60 page. It was like a 60 page, 4 issue goof that Dark Horse was willing to put out with no ads. And, you know, we were taking no money up front because there would be no interference whatsoever. We would just basically, they'd let us do this goofy independent style comic with almost no oversight. Just get your pages in. Because of the legal wrangling between one artist and everything, who was treating it like it was a Marvel or DC project, you know?
Yeah.
The book got held up, even though a lot of us had done actually everybody had done their pages. I have a copy of the original Instant Piano somewhere in my files, with the first cover, and some people had different pages. And my 10 pages, I ended up using them in Dork number 1 because it dragged on for so long. Literally the same thing. I said to Dan, I got these pages. You want me to finish it out and I'll do an anthology and I'll just call it Dork. Because we had you had Hate and Crap and all these other.
Yeah.
One word, Eight Ball and you know, Weirdo. You know, my stuff wasn't. Anyway, I'm not going to compare myself to guys like Bag and Clouds, of course, but that's how you named your books back then, it felt like, you know?
Which 10 pages is it? I have the issue right in front of me.
I couldn't tell you.
It's not The Murder Family?
No, that came out of Epic Light, which was a Marvel one-shot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's weird. It was creator owned though. Kyle did something for that. I forget who else, but I did the cover for that and the first Murder Family, and I think I did a second Murder Family for that, but I don't know if it was for Instant Piano. But eventually, Instant Piano got going, and that's where I came up with the Elkinville Club, because I wanted to do different things. I didn't want to keep doing everything that was in Dork.
Yeah.
So I did the second issue. I came up with the Elkinville Club because Dan Votto was working for DC and got all this really terrible hate mail from an issue he did, and the people were so mean and nasty that Eltingville was a response to that.
Oh, really?
It was only supposed to be 5 pages and I was going to be done, but yeah, he got this horrible, you know, drop dead, I wish you'd get hit, you know, nasty stuff for the day, nasty, some of it nasty even if it was on the internet now, but that stuff was getting pretty bad at that point in the 90s. You know, people were really getting uptight over changes to their favorite characters as if those characters were going to stay dead.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they were real people.
Sure, so sure.
He called me up because he just needed to talk about it because he was getting horrible hate mail.
Uh-huh.
This wasn't the first time, you know, it wasn't just, I hate your books. It was just personal nasty shit because somebody was, some fan, entitled fans were outraged.
Wow.
You know, Eltingville was a reaction to that and things I didn't like in fandom. And it included things about my own life, you know, the lack of a social life in high school, things like that. I mean, my own life is dotted through parts of Eltingville. The comic where Josh rips open all the bread to steal trading cards is straight out of something. At a Bohack in Brooklyn trying to get Battlestar Galactica cards.
Wow.
I just destroyed hundreds of dollars of bread, probably.
Oh my God, that's hysterical. Yeah,
bored and obsessive and not happy in your at home can lead to some really... One day I'm going to do a book about the dopey fan stuff that I did. None of it's as extreme or like funny as Eltingville, but I think that it would all make an interesting case study.
Yeah.
Pre-internet fandom.
Well, I think I read an interview with you a while ago. This was a while ago, so your feelings may have changed. But you said something to the effect of that you would never let Milk and Cheese be like developed into a cartoon.
I never said never. It would be, I would never sell them.
Okay.
I would never dump them unless, you know, it was to save my family or something like that. I would never sell them off.
Gotcha.
I'm not interested in that, but because every deal involved that, and because the deals also cut me out as the person controlling the material.
Really?
Well, yeah, really.
But why?
Well, how many times have you seen a show based on a comic being written by the writer of the comic?
Well, I guess it.
Name five quickly.
Well, no, I can't off the top of my head.
You can write a great comic and they can say you're the best writer on earth, but Hollywood knows how to write a story better than you do.
So that's the biggest thing is that would, because I mean, at the time I read the interview, it was a while ago. I think it was probably because like, oh.
Was it a while ago though?
It was a while ago. But I felt like it was because Milk and Cheese was something that, you know, in its pure sensibility, if you want to call it that, wouldn't work on like a TV show.
If you read... I've said this in interviews, but yeah, you can't have a half hour TV show of Milk and Cheese. You can't have a movie. I've got a file of that I called Hollywood Bullshit, and it was I always tried to get people to send me stuff in writing. Uh-huh. Because I'd love showing that. Because look, can you believe this? They honestly thought that I should have Milk and Cheese living in some like suburban neighborhood, and their foil is I don't remember the guy's name. He's the Chris Farley.
Ooh.
Chris Farley lives next door, and they have like, you know, antics. They're always they fuck with him, and he fucks back with them. And I said, first of all, nobody fucks with them. I'm not saying that because they're cool or anything. It's because that's the way the strip goes. They don't get fucked with unless they're watching terrible television and feel they're getting fucked with.
Yeah.
Nobody, you can't have an antagonist because they win. You know, they win quickly.
Yeah.
It's not about story. It's not about plot. And there's no dramatic tension in there. It's gags.
Yeah.
Quick gags. If it goes six pages, it's pushing it usually. They make fun of the fact that a strip's gone six pages.
Sure.
Milk and Cheese don't, you know, there's a reason that I'm not doing more Milk and Cheese comics, and it has nothing to do with my like or dislike of the characters. I really love those guys. I think they're silly, and sometimes I find myself apologizing for how schmucky the comic is. But every once in a blue moon, I'll look at it and I'll go, you know, there are jokes here that certain people don't seem to recognize. They just react to the drinking. Again, it is what it is. I mean, I put that stuff in there. Yeah. I can't blame people for getting off on the rock and roll, visceral, snotty shit and the pop culture stuff. But there's, you know, there's some strips in there that actually have a point.
Yeah.
Beyond the search and destroy aspects. And plus, I just like drawing them. I mean, I really like them. I think they're funny characters. They're just such selfish little assholes.
Yeah.
And to me, they're America, you know. And they're just little hypocrites, and they're charming, and they're horrible.
Yeah.
But I don't want to. Yeah, I don't want to sell them, and I can't imagine seeing anybody else. Here, I'm gonna put Dragon. I can't imagine seeing anybody else. Writing or drawing them.
Yeah.
And all the offers that we got were for things that they were not suitable for. Puppets that introduced a series of cartoons.
Oh, really?
Jim Henson Nelvana show. That was brilliant. And the woman, I had to tell the woman, you know, they're alcoholics. And she was like silent. And then she's like, I didn't know that. Oh my. And I'm like, yeah. I said, I'm sorry. I understood that Milk and Cheese were being put on everybody's desks for a while.
Uh-huh.
Now every comic is on somebody's desk. Probably a quarter of everyone's sales is people in LA, runners in LA and office people getting them for their bosses. to throw on a desk to go, yes, yes, no, yes, make an offer, no, yes. Let the company have it, yes. I mean, almost more people seem to have an option than don't in comics right now. Yeah. I mean, they option tweets. They option grocery lists at this point, you know?
Sure.
They're going to be optioning intent.
Well, I could, yeah. You're
going to option possibilities, you know. But so, yeah, Milk and Cheese is mine unless the right offer came. And the right offer would have been making one-minute cartoons for MTV or something like that.
Yeah. Well, what about Eltingville Club? I mean, that had a pilot. What happened with that?
I was perfectly willing to ditch Eltingville for money.
Really?
Yes, really.
No, I mean, so you...
no one has a gun to my head. Yes.
No, but I mean, those characters don't hold as much...
They're four horrible people who I am only fond of for... Eltingville is not fun to work on.
And, oh, really?
No, it's not.
Why?
Eltingville is a very negative comment on my industry, and it involves commentary on myself as a person and fandom, and my, you know, how I feel about a lot of these things, myself included. Eltingville is a strip that I'm very happy to finish, not a strip that I'm very happy to be working on. I always knew that I was going to stop Eltingville at some point. Uh-huh. I wanted to stop Eltingville about 15 years ago. It just didn't work out. I started doing more TV stuff and other kinds of comics. And in the 90s and the aughts, I was not able to get a lot of my independent work done. And that's one of the reasons I left Slave Labor. I could not finance my independent comics with nothing up front.
Yeah.
And SG did not have a page rate or an advance.
Gotcha.
And I used to be able to make a lot of comics with them by taking my creator-owned stuff that I had done for for magazines or other comics or punk zines or whatever, and I'd gather them together, doing the Milk and Cheese dork model was take what you had floating around that was released to you, that was not a publisher didn't have any hold on, reprint it as an issue of Dork or Milk and Cheese with new material. So when you're doing five or six pages of new material, that's great. You put a book out and you get paid. Since Dork did okay and Milk and Cheese was starting to do very well by the end of it, I think we were selling like 12,000, 13,000, and that's without a reprint. And, you know, that was years ago, you know, so those were good numbers for a small press book.
Yeah.
Especially. Yeah, they all went into a reprint except the seventh one because we were printing heavier on them. And the book had been in like seven printings or something, the first collection. But I never was able to get Eltingville finished or get an eighth issue of Milk and Cheese going or even try to come back to Hectic Planet Pirate Corps. I squeaked out Dork number 11 because I had to do the entire book from top to bottom on Dork 11 and most of Dork 10, I think, and most of Dork 9. I had to do those without getting paid. Until the back end.
Gotcha.
Back end started to deplete because the industry was going through some sort of through some free fall as far as single. I mean, if you notice, all those comics are gone now. Only Adrian Tomine does a stapled regular comic, and that only comes out every year or two.
Yeah.
Everybody else is doing, you know, Seth does a book, Dan Klaus does a book, Love and Rockets is now perfectly bound, Palookaville is a big book. It just wasn't viable anymore.
Yeah,
there's a lot of so-called independent comics coming out, you know, the kind that Image does. I mean, they are independent, but they're not alternative comics, if you know what I'm saying.
Sure.
That's really become a place for collections and graphic novels, original graphic novels. But yeah, Pete Bagg isn't doing Hate. Dan Klaus isn't doing 8-Ball, you know. I mean, the formats have had to change. So I couldn't just bat out these comics. The market was disappearing. But I'm a dinosaur and I get stuck in my ways. So it was easier for me, just like it was hard for me to show my work to anybody, it was easier for me to just keep going the way things were going. And I was convinced that I would eventually get Milk and Cheese 8 done and get Dork going and finish Eltingville as its own book. I started the first issue of Eltingville in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
First page, then the next year I did the second page, the next year I did the third page, and then it all shut down. And I wasn't getting any comics done. I was getting work done for DC and Marvel and stuff for the Cartoon Network and World's Funnest I got done in 2000, and then we did the Eltingville pilot, and I did some book work, I did some artwork for some books and stuff. I wasn't getting my own comics done, and I was afraid to leave SLG. I just didn't feel right, even though I'd been there over 20 years, and even though I couldn't get the material out, I just hoped something would happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But doing it Dork 11 just broke me. I also set it up as a very stupid issue. It's got like 500 panels or something crazy like that, like 200 jokes. I just wanted to make a joke book in one comic book with as many gags as possible. And by the time I finished it and spent more time on any comic up to that point that I ever had, the sales were not there anymore and the money wasn't there. So I took a bath. Mm-hmm. And that's no one's fault but my own.
Yeah.
Nobody forced me to do any of that stuff. Eltingville turned into the same problem, but I did have an advance. I was getting a page rate. Yeah. But I just took way too long on Eltingville 1 and ridiculous amount of time on Eltingville 2. So I'm glad I'm done with it. But yeah, I mean, I'm off the track again. But Eltingville was something I always knew I was going to get rid of.
Yeah.
I'm going to end it, finish it, collect it, be done. So when the Cartoon Network came to me, they first asked me about Milk and Cheese, and I said I'm not interested because there's no half-hour show there.
Yeah.
And it's like, fine. Mike Lazo was like, that's fine. And then they asked me about Eltingville, and here's the difference. On Eltingville, Sarah and I were producers. I wrote the script. Sarah's story edited the script. I did all the design work. Sarah did the color design work. We picked the actors. They worked, you know, we had a director that we hired, Chuck Sheets from The Simpsons. They were fantastically open, and they gave me the rope to hang myself, you know, or not. And we would have had a show.
Yeah.
That's very different than the usual offer. The usual offer is, we'd like to buy Milk and Cheese from you. We'd like to put an option forward with it, you know, and if we go into production, we own them, and you get checks. And here's the deal that we're offering. And, you know, they don't want me involved.
That's bizarre.
They don't want me to do design work. They don't want me. Now, maybe now something would change because formats are different. Milk and Cheese would be great as a web cartoon, possibly. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Maybe not great, but you could do a minute. You could do a cartoon that's only 30 seconds, 40 seconds. You could do something for mobile. You could do something, an app.
Yeah.
But they're not, it's not the 90s anymore or the aughts, and people aren't as interested. So if something were to be, if something did happen there, I'd be open to it as long as I kept the character, the print rights and the ownership of the characters.
Yeah.
And was involved.
Yeah.
If somebody threw me idiot money, that would, who knows?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Some maniac on the planet, you know, some Saudi guy who owns humans says, $5 million for Milk and Cheese. I'd be like, it would be hard.
Yeah.
It'd be hard. It's like somebody giving you $1 million to get rid of your favorite pet.
Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, it seems easy, right?
Yeah.
You'd think about it a lot if you had a conscious, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Plus, I have other ideas. I mean, we're doing other things. I'm busier than I've ever been since the 90s. I just wish I had the energy. But so I don't need to sell them. But Milk and Cheese, I would be, you know, now that people are watching stuff on their phones that lasts a minute. I mean, in Japan, they have these like 1 minute TV series that they run, you know. Who knows? But no, I would not want to sell them. They're my kids, you know, they're my babies.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Eltingville are just some ugly foster children that hung out with me for a while. That I wanted them out of the car as soon as I got to the body parts farm or whatever.
Gotcha.
I mean, I'm not fond of those characters. I know that sounds weird. If you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah,
They're not fun, pleasant characters to work with. I mean, Milk and Cheese cut people's arms off, and I think I like them more than these poor guys. I mean, Jerry was becoming, I always knew Jerry was going to kind of come out okay.
Yeah.
On the whole, but he's going to be fucked up his whole life. And that Bill is actually a sociopath.
Yeah.
And Pete's just an asshole, and Josh is a disaster. But I have sympathy for them, and I appreciate what they've done for me as far as the comics, you know, they've won some awards. People really like them. They've made people laugh. we had a pilot that ran on the Cartoon Network a couple of times. I mean, that's stuff I never thought would ever happen.
Yeah.
So I, you know, it's small time, but it's for me, it's still big, you know, it's a big deal. So Eltingville, not the thing that was, you know, Milk and Cheese was always supposed to think that blew up, but Eltingville in some ways has been better for me.
Sure. Sure.
Milk and Cheese is what got me the job on Space Ghost, and Sarah and I ended up working for them, and Milk and Cheese is the comic that people read and thought, maybe I could use this guy. So, I mean, you can get those ideas to help you get paying jobs and then keep your babies close. That's, I think, the best way to be able to, if you can't finance it any other way, you know, I don't have a bone style situation. I'm never going to be popular so where my comics are paying for everything.
Huh.
Most people aren't. Most people aren't even in my shape, and I'm not in great shape. I mean, you know what I mean? A lot of people are teaching or, you know, doing other work.
Yeah.
While they do their comics. You would think because you know, it's like bands. You know, the Aquabats had jobs, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of bands, they have jobs they got to go to because they're, you know, just because you're on a stage and you hear about them all the time and they're famous to you doesn't mean that they're selling enough records to keep them going as musicians or as artists. I mean, then they, you know, they end up, Yo Gabba Gabba happened for Christopher, and then the Aquabats got a show. I mean, but you can't bank on that.
Yeah.
Know how much, you know, children's television does not pay very, very great.
Interesting.
No, none of the jobs we've had, the best paying jobs we've had have been for like Warner Brothers shows or Cartoon Network shows that are showing, that are, but Adult Swim, I don't know what it's like now. I'm not going to say that I know what's going on. We haven't done anything for the Adult Swim in a long time. This is not prime time animation or live action filmmaking. This is still the non-three networks and whatnot. So it's tough, you know. You're famous enough, and put that in quotes, and well known enough that people can tell you to go fuck yourself and that you should drop dead because they hate you or hate your work or hate your attitude. But your car is falling apart.
Yeah.
You know, you're taking lumps without much sugar.
Wow. Well,
I'm not saying it's a nightmare, but things have picked up. Last year at this time, I thought I was going to have to leave comics.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, really. I'm just glad that you're still in it. I mean, like I've said to you via email and on this podcast, I mean, you are honestly one of my favorite creators of all time. I've loved your stuff. And
email me a list of who you're into, and I'll tell you who to cross off and start looking at instead, and then you'll ditch me as well.
I'm not going to ditch you. I'm going to keep reading your stuff. And
Yeah, things were very bad last year. Literally at this time last year, lowest point in my life since I was, since I had to borrow $300 to join two friends as roommates.
Really?
Yeah, it was the worst. I mean, also I have more responsibility and I have a family, and you know, but things were bleak. Things were very bleak.
Well, I'm glad it's picking up.
Yeah, it is. Apparently, medical places really need guinea pigs.
Oh, Jesus.
And they'll stick things in you and give you money.
Oh, my God.
Not always unpleasant, either.
Well, I have had you on for almost 2 hours. And
yeah,
I,
you're sick of me. That's
I'm right. not sick of you.
Questions, throw them at me, and I'd be happy to wrap it up.
What's up? What did you just say?
If you have any quick questions that you wanted to get to, feel free, and then we'll wrap this up.
Well, I mean, I just wanted to ask you about, you seem like a technophobe. Like, you work you're still working traditionally, correct? Like, with pencil and ink and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, I don't do art on the computer. I'm not good with it. Also, right now, I'm not drawing at all, pretty much. I'm working on some commissions that I owe some people for quite a while. Uh-huh. But I'm taking, maybe a year off from producing comics regularly.
Uh-huh.
Because my arm and my hand are shot.
Really?
Yeah, Eltingville basically blew my drawing arm out. I did too much work on it. I did too much cross-hatching and detailing. And my arm has always been in bad shape for a while, but now it's in really, like, horrible shape. I just went to a neurologist. I have to make an appointment for an x-ray I have to go into physical therapy, and then after that, they're going to start looking at some musculature stuff and, you know, start looking around at whether it's carpal tunnel or whether it's a nerve thing.
Yeah.
And I've gone in for this once before and nothing came from it. And, you know, I wear a wrist brace a lot and I just don't draw. But I've had to basically just stop drawing comics, which is why I'm busier, because drawing comics eats up a lot of time when you do a lot of detail or do a lot of panels or both. So I'm writing pretty much full time now. Sarah and I are doing two projects together. I'm pitching something with an artist to Dark Horse right now. I'm revamping that. And we did the Ben 10 episode. We did some non-comics design work for a company that we might do some more stuff for. So yeah, it's been a lot of the Peanut story that I did for Boom recently, I didn't draw it. And the I've got a 12-page story for the SpongeBob comic for Mermaid Man. I didn't draw that. I'm really basically just going to write,
okay,
and rest my arm and see what therapy and all that does for it. I'm not going to stop making comics, but I'm not going to work on anything for a while, so I can, you know, see where things land. I mean, I want to draw my own. There's still a project I want to draw my own. I still want to do more stuff like Dork.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll ever get back to Hectic Planet. I used to think I would, but I don't think I ever will. I still want to make some milk and cheese strips every once in a while, for, you know, just for the hell of it.
Yeah.
There's a all ages thing I'd like to do that I want to do from top to bottom. I want to draw it. I might have to get a lettering font of my handwriting, because lettering is where I really tend to alter.
Yeah, you still hand letter, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who do. It's just they don't do it for the, you know, almost everything's done with fonts at DC, Marvel. DC, I think, sometimes will do hand lettering if it's requested.
Yeah.
Most people, though, almost everybody's doing everything on a computer. I mean, Jill's the lettering that Jason Arthur does on Beasts of Burden is Jill's handwriting. It's Jill's font.
Oh, okay.
She painted, she lettered the first four stories, first three stories, but now that's a font. And it looks really good. It has personality. I like when the lettering to me is, it's part of the art. That should go without saying, but people don't see it. A lot of people don't see it that way. But there are also people who don't think silent comics are written. I understand today there's everything's written.
Yeah.
Whether there's lettering or words, everything is figured out and written. If thoughts put into what's going on the page, it's written.
Yeah.
You could argue it's an abstract comic is written. So anyway, yeah, I might have to do that. I would hate to do that. But if that's what I have to do, that's what I have to do.
And you never thought about webcomics or anything like that?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, but I mean, who's going to pay me to do a webcomic? I'm not. Not a kid. I'm 50 years old, and I have all these projects going. I would love to do a webcomic. It would be really cool to do four-panel comics from Door. You know, the fun pages.
Yeah.
Love to do those like twice a week, or do a continuity that wasn't too crazy. The problem is anything I draw, I start to put lines into. I have to kind of deal with that compulsion aspect of my artwork.
Yeah.
Realize just how much line work is enough without hacking, without being cynical about it. But you know, I talk to my therapist about my work a lot, because a lot of my problems come out in my work. The inability to let go of a page or to let anyone see my work in progress, like, you know, or to do I would draw sketches for Mad Magazine. When I would do them, I would basically pencil the whole thing. It wasn't a rough. The thing is, they're hiring you, and they know your artwork, they know your writing. You don't have to turn it a complete job, but my obsessiveness and my fears, I would just do a full drawing for Mad.
Gotcha. And
eventually Sarah started taking them away from me when they were, like, you know, just roughs, and send that to them.
Okay.
And then I'd see that they'd go, this is fine, this is great, just do that. Because they know how I draw. They know how you draw.
Yeah.
You do not need to show them you can draw.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You show them the idea. And that's what I have problems with. I try to show everything all the time. I mean, when we worked in the Cartoon Network, one of the things for the Adult Swim Space Ghost, Mike Lazzo said to us that he really liked about our scripts was that they were complete. Sarah and I never turn in something that goes, and then there'll be a fight scene, and then the, you know, storyboard artists can do some stuff here, or, you know, and I do a comic script, or we do a comic script. We don't, we work at, we choreograph fight scenes, and we work with the artists and go, look, if there's anything you want to put in there so you don't feel stifled. But we don't turn pages over to people to do our job for us. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I totally
feel like a writer who says page 7, fight scene, I don't think they deserve a full page with check for that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
The artist, you know, when John Romita or Gil Kane or somebody, we had really great artists back in the day who knew how to tell stories. We still have a lot of people who can do that these days, but working Marvel style now, there's a lot of people who are more about putting pretty pictures next to one another.
Yeah.
You give them, do a fight, make a fight scene page and give them, or give them 2 pages of something happening, and you don't know what you'll get back. I write as if I don't know who the artist is going to be. If I do know who the artist is, I write towards what they like to do or what I think they can do, or unless I'm, you know, with Jill, when we work together, there's a lot of things that I know she's not, she sometimes can be uncomfortable with when it comes to gore or something like that. So she'll either want to work out a subtle way to do it, or I'll ask her, could you really do it here? And she ends up doing something amazing because it's not a comfort zone for her.
Yeah.
Sometimes you want to push and pull the artist. Sometimes the artist will ask you for something directly to challenge you. So yeah, I mean, yeah.
Well, but yeah, I totally understand.
Right, you know, I don't turn in half-assed stuff, and I don't expect the artist to turn in half-assed stuff. And if they are, I don't expect that when I'm drawing something for somebody else. But I can't draw comics right now. I might do something for an anthology that's coming out next year. It's a themed anthology along the lines of that Peanuts anthology I did a story for. They asked if I would draw it. It's gag oriented, so I think I can do it.
Yeah.
But I would love to do a webcomic. The main reason I'd like to do it, the two reasons I'd love to do a webcomic is, one, generate material on a regular basis. Yeah. Two, have a dialogue with my audience, readership, where they know they're going to get regular work from me, and I get that feedback, which I really miss from the days when I used to put out more comics. When Bill and Ted came out monthly, and then Milk and Cheese and Dork and Hectic Planet, enough of those kinds of, and then I had some one-shot stuff, enough of those comics would come out that I'd have something out at any time. And now it's, well, the schedule on Beasts of Burden is Beasts of Burden has taken a really long time to get going. Again, Jill's back on it, which is fantastic. I mean, the new work is as amazing as ever, but I really can't wait to get that stuff out. Eltingville, I fell apart and just did so much extra work on that that it ended up getting bumped by a year. All my fault, nothing to do with Dark Horse or anybody else. And you know, some projects also just sit for a while.
Yeah.
But it's like everything's bumped up that I'm old enough now that in the next like year I have like 4 books of stuff coming out.
Gotcha.
Of old stuff, which is really like cool. The Bill and Ted's book comes out in a few weeks. Then the Eltingville collection comes out. World's Funnest is getting collected by DC along with a bunch of other material. And then some other thing that I can't talk about yet is going to be coming out. So, you know, if people like my stuff, they can get it.
Yeah. And where can they find you online? Because you got a couple of different, like,
I don't have a website, if you don't know. I just have like a houseoffunstudios.com.
Yeah.
If you go there, it'll have links to other stuff. But you can basically Evan Dorkin at Jeep. I don't know. What is my Twitter?
I don't know off the top of my head.
It's just my name, I guess. Hold on, I'll go look.
It's like E. Dorkin or something.
No, it's not E. Dorkin.
Or something.
I have more than E in front of something like Dorkin to just kind of like soften the blow of that last name.
Oh, come on.
You know, you have to have a little, if I didn't have a name, in comics, I would probably use my middle name. No, I wouldn't use my middle name, but I'd get rid of Dorkin. Let's put it that way.
Well, Dorkin works for Dork, so, you know.
Dorkin works for nobody.
It works for me.
It's a I'm just at Evan Dorkin, yeah.
Yeah, that's okay.
At Evan Dorkin, and I think I'm on...
You have Live Journal, too. That's where I...
Yeah, because I'm old. And I still update that sometimes. Well, because I like, you know, you can tell, as you get 140 characters for somebody like me is
stifling.
So that's why sometimes I go on things people have decided to call Twitter rants for me.
Yeah.
And even if they're not a rant, they call them a rant because I guess they sound like a rant. I could be talking about how nice the sky is and somebody will say, Evan Dorkin's ranting on Twitter. That's my fault.
Well, listen, I'm going to let you go because I've had you on for 2 hours.
All right, let me go.
But I really appreciate you being on. I've had Evan Dorkin on the line. And
2 hours.
For 2 hours, I'm going to split this up into two. I'm just going to let
you know.
I got off. Well, I would love to sit and talk to you all night, but I've got to make my family dinner. So
yeah, don't you love your family? Don't you want to be with them instead?
I do. Well, this is sort of like a Sophie's choice that you're giving. Not really.
Absolutely not.
No, but
shoot, Sophie.
Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate your time. And
I'm sorry it took so long for us to set this up with getting sick and everything.
No. No, it's totally fine. And, you know, New York Comic Con will wipe anyone out. So I really appreciate your time. And, you know, if you ever want to come on again, I would love to have you. And,
you know, next year, if something comes out, we can, you know, put a timer on it. So after an hour, it shuts down. You don't have to talk to me again. But when I have some new stuff out, maybe. Real quick. One of the projects Sarah and I are doing is for Stila, which you may have seen the announcements for. They've just started doing press. It's an online... It's a mobile app that will be running new comics.
Oh, really? What's it called?
It's called Stila, Stela.
Okay.
Google-de-goo that.
I will.
We've got about 30 series in development. They're going to be launching with 5, and it's going to be daily comics with weekly updates.
Oh, cool.
About 8 pages of comics. The technical stuff is, like you said, not up my alley. So, but we've written the first 3 chapters of our comic. It's creator-owned. It's a genre thing. So that'll be announced, I think, in February, maybe. Yeah. I think we're part of the third wave, maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
So, you know, if you want to have us on after, you know, maybe Sarah and I, she's good at telling me that I'm talking too much.
Absolutely. I would love to have you on anytime you want to come on.
Right. All the books will be out, so feel free.
I appreciate your time, and thank you so much. And, you know, I will leave you with this, that your work has meant a lot to me, like I've said several times, and I just am happy to have you on my podcast.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you wanting to have me on. Thank you.
Great. And my name is Christian Horn, and this has been actually turning out to be another 2 episodes of Part-Time Fanboy, but I love
it. This is my legacy, yeah.
No, but I love it.
Full-time talker.
All right. Well, thank you to anyone for listening, and please check Evan Dorkin's artwork. He's got a lot of stuff coming out, which I've already pre-ordered on Amazon. And join us next week for another episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
I'm not doing part-time. I'm not doing.